All right, everyone. Hi. While we get ready to get started, I'm going to actually take a picture of all of you because it's so great to see you all in person. Here we go. All right, the best wide angle possible. All right, here we go. See how everyone just quieted? That's fantastic. You guys are awesome. Yay. Okay, I'm going to cheese. Can we all say cheese? Or how about S-E-J? S-E-J. It's S-E-J. Okay, we may have to work on that one a little bit. Well, welcome. It's so good to see you. My name is Sadie Babbitts. For those of you who don't know me, I am the president of the board for SEJ. This is my second term. Thank you. Thank you very much. It has truly been an honor to lead the board and be such a part of an organization that has given me so much as a journalist and now as an educator as well. And so when I'm not working on SEJ stuff, I am actually a professor of practice and a content director, a sustainability director at Arizona State University at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And I love this now. I have a soundtrack. We're just going to go with that. And what that means, because I sometimes ask myself what that means, is I get to work with young journalists who are just starting out on their journey to be environmental reporters, and it's such an honor. And I see, and I know we have a lot of student journalists here tonight, so I just want to give you a shout out. Thank you for being here. It's awesome. So I don't like to talk about myself, so I'm going to stop. Let's talk about all of you and this great community of SEJ. Do you realize it's been since 2019 that we actually gathered in person for a conference? 2019. It was the before times. Here we are tonight. It's so wonderful to be here. So first, I want to just take a moment to honor the land and acknowledge the land that we are currently residing on. And please forgive me if I mispronounce any names, but I feel that this is important to take the moment to acknowledge the land. So I'd like to acknowledge the lands of the Karakawa, the Sana, the Atakapa Ishka, and the Kawi-Tikan. And now we move into that part of the program where we have a lot of wonderful people to thank, because it takes a tremendous effort to bring together all of you for what is going to be hopefully an inspiring and in-depth experience for you here at the conference. We simply could not do this without the help of our hosts, Rice University, and our major sponsors. Yes, let's give them applause. Absolutely. Thank you, Rice University. I'd also like to thank our major sponsors, including the Hewlett Foundation. Thank you. The Walton Family Foundation. Thank you so much. A special thanks to Matt Trousseau with the Environmental Defense Fund as well. Oh, we've got some fans. Yay. And a special thanks to all of our exhibitors and sponsors, so many that I wish I had time to name. But when you see them, please say hi and thanks. Thank you all so much for being the light here to help bring together SEJ and help the journalists that really are telling the world's most pressing environmental stories of our time. There are two other people here in the audience that I want to say thanks to, because we could not do this conference without them, and that's our SEJ 2022 co-chairs, Navina Sadasivam. Thank you. Yes. And Perla Treviso. Perla. I promise you're going to hear more from both of them in just a minute when I get off the stage here. First, a little housekeeping. I just want to say that SEJ is committed to maintaining an environment in which everyone is treated with respect and dignity without harassment. At this event, no form of unlawful or prohibited discriminatory or harassing conduct by or towards anyone, whether that's an SEJ employee, a member, a board member, a speaker, an invited guest, an exhibitor, an event attendee, vendor, or contractor, or a volunteer will be tolerated. Anyone who believes that they have been subjected to harassment or discrimination of any kind within the meaning of this policy, please report it immediately to Megan Parker, our executive director. She's waving her hand out there. Thank you, Megan. Or you can come see me as well. Secondly, on a lighter note, the late deadline for entering our SEJ Awards for Excellence in Environmental Reporting is less than a week away. How did that happen? I have no idea. April 5th is the deadline to be eligible for cash prizes, including the $10,000 Nina Mason Pulliam Award for the best of the best. And we're going to talk about that for a minute. The 2021 Pulliam Award went to Where Will Everyone Go? How Climate Refugees Might Move Across International Borders. And that was by Abram Lustgarten and a team of journalists with ProPublica and the New York Times Magazine. And we want to take just a minute here to say that the judges, they praised it as masterful in weaving data, stories, issues, migration, and what climate change feels and tastes like for people who have no choices. So we're going to take a minute, and we're going to hear from Abram, who's going to talk about how this incredible story came to be. Over here.
I mean, I've been covering the environment for 20 years or so, and at ProPublica for the better part of 15 years. And it's in the last 6 or 7 years that's just steadily turned towards, you know, looking at climate's effect on human migration. We had this model that the bank had begun to develop that actually looked at specific numbers and predicted that migration, but only on a very sort of, you know, spatially limited scale. And so we set out from the outset to see if we might be able to either build something similar, or what we ended up doing was evolving the model that they had built to try to answer the question that I wanted to answer about, you know, how people would cross international boundaries and what the sort of big, broad continental trajectories of their motion would be. And with a grant from the Pulitzer Center, you know, we were able to hire and work with some of the researchers who had done that World Bank modeling, enhance their model, add some layers to it, some complexity that would go towards answering questions that I was asking, and develop that to look at how people would migrate out of Central America towards the United States. The model shows us how urbanization is one result of sort of early stage migration, that migration proceeds in a stepwise pattern to cities and then beyond borders and then further north towards a prosperous country like the United States. And that's very much what I found in Central America. I'm incredibly grateful for this recognition from SEJ. It's so encouraging to continue to do this work and also just to be supported by, you know, our peer community, a colleague community. And it's a nice honor then to be recognized for that work by your peers as well.
And a huge congratulations to Abram and his colleagues for that. That type of reporting would not have been possible without the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust. So thank you for helping to increase and improve environmental journalism. Now, it is my distinct honor to bring to the stage and introduce two women, Navina and Perla, who have been working night and day, and I am not joking about this, to bring you at tonight's amazing program. Navina is a staff writer covering the environment, energy, and climate change at Grist. She previously covered environmental issues at the Texas Observer, Inside Climate News, and ProPublica. And Perla is a reporter for the ProPublica Texas Tribune Investigative Initiative. Previously, she spent more than 10 years covering immigration and border issues in Tennessee and Arizona before joining the Houston Chronicle as an environmental reporter. Navina and Perla, come on up here. Welcome.
Hello, everyone. First of all, thank you so much for being here. We couldn't be happier to see so many faces. I'm Perla, and I'm from El Paso, and yes, it's still considered Texas, even if we get to keep our lights on.
And hi, everyone. I'm Navina. I am not from Texas, but I used to live in Austin, and I continue to cover Texas issues for Grist. Like Perla said, like Sadie said, it's really great to be here in person with all of you after 2 years of a global pandemic. We have, if you can believe it, almost 600 people signed up for the conference, and for most of you, big round of applause for that. 600 people are here. And for most of you, it's probably your first in-person conference in several years. I know it certainly is for me. You know, in the last few years, how we think about environmental stories has shifted significantly, right? Today, when we talk about environmental issues, we're thinking both about the natural environment and the built environment, right? And no place touches on these issues quite like Houston. We have increasingly climate-fueled disasters hitting the Houston area. Houston has had 7 federally declared disasters in just the past 6 years, you know, with, of course, black and brown communities being impacted disproportionately. And it's no coincidence that these communities in East Houston that are close to major refineries and petrochemical facilities suffer from higher rates of asthma and other respiratory diseases. Children who live near heavily industrial Houston Ship Channel are much more likely to develop leukemia. You know, we know from years of research and the lived experience of Houstonians that such issues are no accident. As early as in the 1970s, Dr. Bob Bullard, who you'll hear from later on this evening, was finding that environmental hazards like dumps and incinerators were disproportionately being cited in black communities.
But these communities are taking action. You have communities in neighborhoods like Pleasantville, the Fifth Ward, Sunnyside, who are installing their own air monitoring networks to get data and be able to fight back and get the information they need. And it's precisely because of these communities that it's more important than ever that we as journalists not only highlight the problems, some of them, which we just talked about right now, but also the communities that are being harmed by it. Texas has been in the news a lot lately. We probably all know why, but there's been some laws, including around voting, abortion, trans rights. And there's some concern, right? We've heard from some of you about why are we holding a conference in Texas? Is this the right moment? But I think the communities that we talked about is precisely why we need to be here. Journalists go to places where the problems are. I grew up in El Paso. I played around in this playground that I much later on found out was actually built on the city's oldest landfill. Growing up along the border meant that the air quality was much worse than in other places. The neighborhood where we lived was right around the corner from the oil refinery, but my family didn't know any of this. I didn't know any of this, and I can't tell you how many times working here in Houston, I was the first to tell a family that the pollution was worse where they lived, that they had more cancer risk because that's where they could afford to live in.
And, you know, that's exactly why we're here. These are the types of issues that we want to highlight during this conference. The tours tomorrow will take you down to the Houston Ship Channel on a ferry, to the wooded areas around the Big Thicket, along a contentious section of I-45 that the state is now trying to expand, and to Refinery Row, where communities have long lived in the shadow of massive petrochemical plants. Or you can join one of the many dozens of panels scheduled for Friday and Saturday to learn about everything from the Clean Water Act to covering indigenous communities respectfully and just following the money, you know, which is just what journalists do.
Doesn't all this sound amazing? Don't you wish you could go on every single tour and be at every panel, right? I do.
Unfortunately, many of these panels are concurrent, so you will have to make some tough decisions.
And, you know, none of this would be possible without our supporters like Rice University, which is hosting our conference. Provost Reginald DeRoche unfortunately could not be here with us tonight, but he did leave us a welcoming message that you are going to see right now.
Good evening and welcome to Houston. I'm sorry I couldn't be here with you in person. I hope your short time so far has been pleasant, and that over the next few days, you will get to know our wonderful city and Rice University. When I first arrived 5 years ago, one of the things I was most struck by was the ability of our faculty, students, staff, and alumni to rally around a cause for the greater good. Preserving our environment is one of those causes. Our entire campus is working in full force with various partners across the greater Houston area on issues such as energy transition, coastal adaptation, and environmental justice and equity. Both Houston and Rice are uniquely positioned to work on issues related to the environment. Houston is home to 24 Fortune 500 companies and the largest medical center in the country. It has a mixture of industry expertise, including energy, manufacturing, aerospace, and tech. And Houston has the number one U.S. port in waterborne tonnage and the second highest concentration of engineers, and is the most diverse city in the U.S. The city recently more forcefully responded to the climate change issues by recognizing that if we are to continue to be the leading center on energy innovation and management, we must be at the forefront of developing, implementing, and transitioning to clean technologies. Rice is playing and must continue to play a significant role in supporting that change. The success of both Rice University and Houston are closely intertwined, not only with respect to our future competitiveness, but also in our shared vulnerabilities to the impacts of climate change on the Gulf Coast. Rice is a university where environmentally minded research, teaching, and outreach happen across the breadth of the university. This kind of collaboration is central to understanding current and coming environmental challenges. More than 130 faculty and staff self-identify as environmental scholars and researchers, with 90 tenure-track faculty from 7 schools and 23 departments. Key research interests include climate change and mitigation, biodiversity loss and conservation, coastal adaptation, energy transition, urban environments and water, and environmental justice and equity, with strong support for impactful change and solution-oriented research. The university also hosts many important centers and programs, including the B Carbon Group, an innovative collaborative dedicated to creating new ways to incentivize natural carbon sequestration, the Carbon Hub, which brings together engineers, chemists, and material science to develop creative approaches to accelerating the energy transition, the Center for Environmental Studies, which, through a recent Mellon grant, has created many new impactful programs on campus, including the Excellent Planet Now program series, community partnerships, internships, and much more. The Severe Storm Prediction, Education, and Evacuation from Disaster Center provides crucial tools for our community in flood response. The Center for Energy Studies at the Baker Institute and the Kinder Institute for Urban Research. Just this year, Rice established our commitment to sustainability as an overarching policy that spans all facets of the university's actions. The policy encompasses how we manage our endowment to our operational environmental commitment on campus, to supporting environmental research, and finally to fostering student leadership. By making these commitments, we are placing investments in the environment as one of the university's highest funding priorities. As I said earlier, when Rice puts its mind to something, things happen. Achieving sustainability is a long-term challenge that will require bold, interdisciplinary thinking over the next several decades. We are up to this task and are working as we speak on being catalysts for conversations, scholarship, and technological advances that will be required for this ambitious undertaking. I hope you will enjoy learning more over the next few days about the work that's being done at Rice and in Houston to solve some of the world's most pressing problems.
Thank you, Provost DeRoche, for welcoming us to Houston. Our next speaker is Christian Menefee, who is the county attorney for Harris County. Elected at 32 years old, he is the youngest person and the first African-American to serve as Harris County Attorney, the largest county in the state. Please welcome him on stage.
Good evening. Okay, I thought somebody said this was the first conference that you all have been to in a few years. Good evening. Awesome. I'm Christian Menefee. I'm the Harris County Attorney. I was sitting up here chatting with some folks at the head table, and somebody said, "You're the what?" And I said, "I'm the county attorney." And they're like, "Wait, so have you been to law school yet?" And I can confirm that part of the requirements for being county attorney is that you have to have went to law school. So I have been to law school, but I'm the youngest and the first African-American elected to this role. I'll talk a little bit later about what the role is, but I want to first welcome you all to Texas And I want to welcome you here at a very important time. You know, we've heard some discussion already from Perla about some of the laws that have been passed out here, restrictions on folks' eligibility to participate in the voting process. Of course, we recently, just in the past couple of weeks, had our governor issue a directive to our state Child Protective Services Agency to investigate parents of transgender children. And there's any number of onerous laws that have been passed, and I'm happy to report that my office has sued the governor and the attorney general for just about every single law. And directive that they've put in place. So we're happy that you all are here with the folks who are suing the state. I consider Houston home. I grew up in a military family, but I spent most of my childhood here in Houston. And one thing to know about Houston is if you grow up here, and I'm sure Dr. Billard will corroborate this a little bit later, if you grew up in this town, you grew up within a few miles of some facility that emits very, very toxic contaminants, right? My family is from the Fifth Ward area, and just about a mile from where my father and all of his siblings and his mother came up, there is a legacy creosote contamination site, which was a rail yard, and which has led to folks living throughout that area with cancer and many folks passing away. My high school was just a couple of miles from a Superfund site. So I say all this to say that I know some of you maybe have traveled in from all over the country, but here in Houston, this is kind of par for the course for us. It's something that you become used to, and it means that we have these environmental issues that permeate and that communities don't even really see as major issues because they just think that it's part of coming up here in Houston. I'm sure many of you are wondering, what the hell does a county attorney do? When I was running for office, the best way to explain it was, I'm not the district attorney. I do not prosecute criminals. Instead, it's a unique office in that I am the chief civil lawyer for Harris County. It's more than 60 elected officials, and it's more than 18,000 employees. I run an office of about 250 folks. Of course, most of that isn't relevant to the conversation here today. The part that is relevant is we're effectively the chief enforcement agent for environmental violations here in Harris County, which I'm sure you all can imagine there are a bunch. In the introduction, we heard some discussion about some of the plant explosions that we've seen here in the past few years. Another fun fact about Houston is we don't have zoning. And so you may have a facility that emits toxic contaminants, and it's not kind of cordoned off in some hole deep in the county, right? It's right next to a neighborhood. We had ITC, we had Arkema, we had the Exxon facility. At 4 a.m. in January of 2020, there was an explosion at a manufacturing plant in the northwest side of town. I was living on the southeast side of town, and at 4 a.m., in that January morning, I woke up because I heard the explosion. When the smoke cleared, you had neighborhoods that were leveled and folks who had passed away because this manufacturing facility, which ran into an issue in the wee hours of the morning, was directly next to residential housing. And so this is something that we see relatively often here in Harris County. And so, of course, the question becomes, well, what the hell are y'all doing about it? And the answer is, we're trying, but the state of Texas has, over the past several years, really made it a priority to undermine the work that's been being done by large counties and cities, but more specifically by this office. So our office, really over the past decade, and this predates me, so it's good work, but I can't take credit for it, has been one of the leading voices in environmental compliance and environmental enforcement actions, right? Here in the state of Texas, if you have an emissions event, you know, there are certain penalties that are associated with it, the number one being a $25,000 per day per violation penalty, which if you speciate, you're able to run up the cost a bunch and go after some of these companies, right, because of these large-scale environmental events that happen. Well, 6 or 7 years ago, the state of Texas decided that that was not a very industry-friendly rule. And although you can control what happens at the state governmental level, when you have local governmental officials who are pursuing these actions, you don't have any control over them, and they go after industry. Industry are the donors for the folks at the state, and so it creates a recipe for disaster. And so what the state did was embark on a campaign to really defang the Harris County Attorney's Office, and they passed what I call the trifecta of really terrible environmental policy. The first law was a damages cap. So what this does is for the first $4.13 million that you bring in any penalties case, right? So let's say some large-scale refinery has an explosion, right? Kids are having to be evacuated out of their schools. Maybe a few people die. People end up with conditions that impact them for years. And the local governmental organization brings a lawsuit against that company. Well, under this new law, for the first $4.13 million in damages, it has to be split 50-50 between the state of Texas and the local government. The local government is then capped at that 2.5-ish million, and they cannot get a single dollar above that amount. Of course, that disincentivizes local governments from bringing these types of actions, because if it's a large-scale issue and it impacted a bunch of neighborhoods and you're going to have to invest $1 million worth of resources to go and get those monies, it doesn't make much sense if you're capped out in damages. So that was the first law. The second law, which I think has been the most detrimental, is a law that now requires that our office give notice to the state of Texas before we bring these penalty suits. So what was happening before is you had a race to the courthouse because this issue was not addressed in the law, and so you had the state of Texas who had a vested interest in going after these companies so that they controlled the lawsuit, and if they wanted to settle for pennies on the dollar, they could, right? And then you had local government who wanted to be in the courtroom against these companies as well. So the minute that a large-scale environmental issue happened, you would have both the state and the county rushing to the courthouse to go file their lawsuit first. State government said, oh, no, that's no good. So they passed a law requiring that if the Harris County Attorney's Office or any local governmental entity files a lawsuit against a corporation after a massive explosion, they have to give the state X amount of days, let's say 60 days notice, so that the state can decide if it wants to take the case away from the local governmental entity. And I'm sure you're all thinking, well, why the hell would you do that? Well, the argument is, ostensibly, this is about ensuring uniformity across the state for industry. But what we've seen happen in practice is that the state pretty much summarily takes every single case of consequence that involves a large-scale environmental emissions event, explosion, whatever it may be, and ultimately those cases end up getting settled for pennies on the dollar. Whereas, you know, because folks here locally who are in a better position to understand the impact on communities, understand, you know, the bad acting companies and really go after them, you know, cases that we would fight vigorously are now being settled for pennies on the dollar. And the third of the trifecta is the most distasteful of the laws, although it's not as impactful as some of the other ones. It's the Mother May I law. So one of the ways that this office used to finance bringing these lawsuits, and mind you, I should have given you my background. Before I ran for office, I worked at two large law firms here in Texas. So I have represented just about every single international oil and gas company that exists. I've been on the other side of this. I've been in the boardrooms. I've put corporate executives on the witness stand. I've seen that side of it. I've seen how the decisions are made and how risk is evaluated and how people will cut corners because they think it's necessary for the bottom line. So when you bring these lawsuits, you're going up against the firms that I used to work for, right? They're going to put a bunch of young me's, and yes, younger than me, me's, on the cases, and we're going to bill a bunch of hours. We're going to find the case that you can't find, and ultimately in the courtroom, we're going to make it really, really difficult for you because we're being paid a whole lot of money from a large organization to do this. Local governments can't afford that, right? I'm able to attract a certain level of talent, but we're not able to put in the resources, the time, the monies in order to prosecute these cases. And so the way that those cases used to be funded was we would engage outside counsel on a contingency fee basis, right? Like, look, we don't know if there's something here. We think that there may be, but ultimately you're going to have to put the money up, and if we win on the end, you're going to take a percentage of it, but if we don't, sorry, you're out of luck. Well, the law that they passed now requires that we go and get permission from a single individual before we can hire outside counsel on a contingency fee basis. Now, there are a lot of people in the state of Texas who I would put on a list before this person to have to ask permission, including my mother. But this person is the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton. So now, before I can hire outside counsel to engage a law firm through a contingency fee arrangement to bring a lawsuit against a corporation for corporate malfeasance, for a large-scale environmental event, for marketing products deceptively to kids, I have to get permission from the Attorney General's office, and the AG's office has pretty broad authority to just tell me, no, we're not going to let you do that. And so that, as you can imagine, has led to a decrease in the number of cases that we're able to bring, because more often than not, the AG's office will just say, no, we're going to look into it, and then they'll never actually look into it. But despite all of these things, we still fight on. We have really had to evolve to think of creative ways to continue the fight and ensure environmental compliance and enforcement. And there are a few things that we've done that I want to talk to you about. The first is we're very active in challenging permits. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with the TCEQ. They have a permitting process for different types of facilities to get different types of permits. My experience, and I wouldn't put too much in this because I've only been at it for a year and a half, but my experience is these processes tend to be sham processes sometimes. And if the corporation crosses a few T's and dots a few I's, then they're able to get their permit. And so in many instances, we will try for a contested case hearing and go in and challenge these permits. And although the TCEQ will kind of bat their eyes at us, many times the company will come to the table because they don't want to have to deal with the issue of potential litigation from the local governmental entity. So a good example is there was a large refinery that was out in the Manchester area. They applied for a permit to emit 512 tons per year of a chemical called hydrogen cyanide. I know nothing about science, but that sounds really terrible. We challenged their permit, and we were able to get them agree to decrease their emissions by more than 80% per year to 100 tons per year, which still doesn't sound very good, but it's something. We were able to get them to agree to stack testing and to a six-figure fund that's going to be put into local communities who are dealing with issues because of this plant. So that's one way that we're able to continue to try to fight these fights. The second area that we're able to have an impact is one that is less popular with some of my colleagues, and that is we sue the state of Texas. You know, it's part of the game. I always try to explain to my elected colleagues who take issue with our lawsuits, I'm a litigator, people get sued, it happens, it's not the end of the world, don't take it personally. But we have sued Texas agencies for any number of issues that are either related to environmental issues or adjacent. The two big ones that come to mind is we sued the TCEQ over the new updated standard permit for concrete batch plants. There are a bunch of issues with it, the main one being it really doesn't address the crystalline silica issue with these facilities. Many of you know that these facilities tend to be in neighborhoods of folks who look like me, including Fifth Ward. There are plenty of them. So we sued them because we feel like they ran a sham process when they updated that permit. And of course, a lot of the process was not in Spanish, which makes no sense given that we're one of the largest Spanish-speaking populations in the country. The second is we sued the Texas Department of Transportation over the I-45 redesign, which is a $7 billion project where they're going to widen certain parts of the I-45 highway. Sounds really good. Update infrastructure. The problem is it goes through a bunch of poor black and brown neighborhoods and is going to lead to any number of environmental issues for these communities. And of course, there's a cumulative impact, right? These are the very same communities that have the metal recyclers, the concrete batch plants right in their backyard. So suing the state of Texas is another area that we've been able to kind of really have an impact, not just locally, but statewide. And then the final is looking for every single opportunity to partner with the federal government. You know, it's funny, when I was growing up, I always believed, oh, I see the world this one way, and so I want to vote for a president who sees the world the same way as me. And it wasn't really serious to me on like a personal day-to-day level. It was just something I believed out in the stratosphere. But having seen for the first time in elected office a presidential administration change from one who doesn't necessarily see the world the way that I do to one who does, it has really been impactful on the work that we do on a day-to-day. And the greatest example of that is the chemical disaster rule, right? So this is an Obama-era rule that was put in place to ensure that communities, including those like, you know, Harris County and the Gulf Coast, are in a good position to be able to mitigate the impacts of large-scale chemical disasters, prevent them when they happen, spread information as fast as possible to first responders and to communities. When the previous presidential administration took over, the first thing that they did with respect to environmental protection was to roll back all of those enhanced protections that were added to the EPA. And so we did what any good lawyer does, and we filed a lawsuit against the EPA with some states and a couple of local governments across the country to get them to reinstate the chemical disaster rule. And, of course, when our current president was elected and appointed Administrator Regan to the EPA, they're now on a listening tour, and they're going to be rolling out a new chemical disaster rule this fall. which, fingers crossed, is not going to just bring back what was in place during the Obama administration, but also enhance some of those protections, because in no place are these issues more important than here in the Ship Channel, which is the largest petrochemical complex in the country. You know, we talk a lot about some of the issues that we experience here in Harris County, explosions, hurricanes, but just imagine for a second a hurricane going through the Ship Channel, right, and just laying waste to all the facilities that are out there and what that could mean for these fence line communities and really for folks across Harris County. So it's important stuff that needs to be changed. But if you hear nothing else about what I've said, just know that we're in a state that I believe is very friendly to industry and very hostile to local governments that are looking to, you know, effectuate compliance and enforcement for our communities. So we're doing what we can. Every day is a new challenge. I think that there was a time in Texas politics where if you were sitting in this chair, you kind of had free rein to go out and sue whoever was necessary to make sure that they did the right thing. But the fact of the matter is the rules of the road change every single legislative session. So we do what we can to be nimble and to try to respond to these disasters, both the natural ones, the chemical ones, and those in the legislature. And we're going to continue to do this work. But I really appreciate you all giving me the opportunity to come and chat with you about some of the work that we do. I know that there's going to be a little fireside chat here later, so I'm going to stick around just in case you have any questions. But we're very excited to have you all here in Texas and especially here in Houston, and I hope that you have a great conference. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Menefee. That was great. Our next guest is Daniel Cohen. He's an associate professor of civil and environmental engineer at Rice University. Dr. Cohen's book, Confronting Climate Gridlock, How Diplomacy, Technology, and Policy Can Unlock a Clean Energy Future, was just released actually today. So please help me welcome Dr. Cohen.
Thank you, Perla, and thank you, Navina, and great to be meeting some of you who I've only spoken to by phone or Zoom and meet you in person. Some of you may be wondering why you came to Houston, why you came to Texas for an environmental journalism conference, and I think some of you were wondering even more as you went either up or down I-45 from whatever airport you chose and then saw some of you tweeting from your hotel rooms and the lovely vistas of I-610 and I-69 coming together in one of the three worst interchanges in all of Texas. But there's a lot of good reason to be here. For one thing, things matter here. Everything, as we like to say, is bigger in Texas. So the biggest oil and gas industry and production and the chemicals that come from it. We're not really a coal state in terms of mining, but we use so much electricity, waste so much electricity, that we actually burn more coal than any other state. With that comes more of the greenhouse gas climate warming pollutants, as well as the sulfur and nitrogen oxide pollutants. And unfortunately, we added a new superlative to our list last year with the February blackouts that those who may have been in California experienced the wildfire blackouts. There was about 150 times as much blackout, people, hours exposed to blackouts, over 200 people. Who died. Some of the investigative journalism suggests it was a few times higher. So a lot of problems here to study, and journalists, of course, that gives a lot of room for stories. But there's also a lot good going on here in superlative ways. Of course, Texas famously played a big role in putting a man on the moon for the first time in so much of the space race, with NASA just down the road from here. Actually, Rice helped NASA get the land for that. And as my son ceaselessly points out, this is now the new home of Elon Musk and the Tesla and SpaceX, Tesla moving into Austin and SpaceX, where he was really disappointed. We only saw it from the boat on our South Padre vacation. We were the first to have a carbon capture plant at a large scale at a coal power plant, and the first to close it very quietly. Without much notice, after bringing in journalists from around the world. And the first to try a new way of doing carbon capture as well, something called the alum cycle that I think maybe will, might have more potential than than what was done before. We lead the country in wind, not percent, but in terms of how many wind turbines are out there. We were way behind for a while in solar. I used to joke with my class, how are we behind tiny states like Massachusetts and New Jersey that you could fit into a tiny corner of Texas and are darker? But we are adding solar faster over this 2 years than any state has added in a two-year span. Could easily surpass California in solar soon, and largely because Texas added transmission lines faster than any other state did for a decade. We can actually get things done in some ways. Is that, you know, where other states, there are so many things blocking construction, and one of the biggest things, I think, getting in the way of the environmental movement, a lot of what I talk about in Confronting Climate Gridlock, the book, is that we've gotten good at blocking things, we haven't gotten so good at building things. Well, Texas actually built something with over $7 billion of transmission lines that is what catapulted the wind and now is pushing solar forward and now is filling up and by not adding more is getting in the way of the transition. I can go on and on with these facts and throw facts at you, but you're journalists, and so your job is to ask questions and to come here and be inspired and find what questions do you want to ask in this new place or this place that you've been to for many years. As Einstein famously said, a paraphrase, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but if I had an hour to solve a question that my life depended on, I would spend 55 minutes figuring what's the proper question to ask and 5 minutes solving it. So here are some of the questions that I would ask, but it's really up to you to ask the questions. You're the journalists here. I'll be watching how will our oil and gas industry, what makes us call ourselves the energy capital of the world, but that historically has meant the hydrocarbon capture of the world, how will it adapt to the energy transition? How will it lead the energy transition? Will it just be a matter of greenwashing? Will it just be a matter of slogans? Will it just be a matter of corporate statements that don't really do any good, and that eventually maybe that'll, you know, get people satisfied for now, but people see through that. There are a lot of smart people out there. There's the French government that blocked imports of LNG from Texas and the Permian because of the environmental footprint here. So will it just be greenwashing? Will it just be a cover? Or will we really move things forward? There's a level of expertise that went into building offshore platforms that can go into building offshore wind. There's expertise, the people that I interviewed for the book who were developing geothermal, and I met them when they were getting started in clean tech incubators in California at Berkeley National Labs. They decided to move their companies to Texas because they needed the expertise in the fiber optics and the horizontal drilling to be able to get geothermal to a way that I could see being on the cusp of the sort of takeoff that we've seen with solar in the past decade. Will Texas be transformational in pushes like geothermal, in technologies for offshore wind, probably not the offshore wind here? Will we finally start getting back to advanced biofuels, especially with some of the oil issues in Europe today with algae or cellulosic or other things, where the expertise that the chemical industry and other industries here have could be pivotal in that? As someone who's studied the electricity grid for a lot in recent years, and especially since the blackouts, are we going to finally end our parochialism of feeling like we need to have this isolated grid and where we can export and import every other form of molecule and energy around the country and around the world? Are we going to finally stop locking in our electrons, locking in our electricity within the state? Because if we did open up, we wouldn't have those blackouts, and we would be able to export wind and solar and make it a lot easier to clean up the grid in the rest of the country. And will we be a proving ground for important new technologies? There's a lot of talk here about competing for Texas to be one of the big hydrogen hubs. Secretary Granholm at Department of Energy has set a goal of $1 a kilogram green hydrogen, out of reach at the moment, like $1 a watt solar was out of the reach when they launched their sunshine initiative. Will Texas help get to that really transformational level of that? Will we be a leader in carbon capture and storage, not just in a project that gets mothballed after 3 years at one of the dirtiest coal plants in the country, but will we actually be in a way that pulls carbon out of industry in more affordable and lasting ways that starts having some of the technologies that perhaps does drawdown of carbon dioxide? And there's a climate adaptation story here, too. we're already a hot and humid city. We already got hit by Hurricane Harvey that hit its own superlatives with the most rain that's ever fallen in anywhere in the continental U.S. in a 72-hour period. How are we going to adapt? How are we going to prepare ourselves for flooding that could get worse, for droughts? We forget about droughts here since 2011 was our last one, but droughts that are likely to get more severe in a hotter and more humid climate than we have. So those are just a few questions that I would be asking, but there are hundreds of you here with far better ideas, far better questions than I have. So I encourage you to come to town, to ask those questions, to talk and listen to such great panelists and experts that you'll have on your tours tomorrow and the other events throughout this week and weekend, and hopefully take a time away from asking those questions. And there's a lot of beautiful parts of Houston, too. So I hope you go out and find something more beautiful than you've been tweeting from your hotel rooms here and find something special to take back with you from Houston. So welcome to Texas, and pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Next up, we have a pre-recorded video from Congressman Raul Grijalva. Congressman Grijalva is a Democrat from Arizona, and he chairs the House Natural Resources Committee. He will now share a few words about an important piece of upcoming legislation.
Good evening, and thank you to the Society of Environmental Journalists for inviting me to give some brief comments at your conference. And I'm particularly pleased that the focus of this conference is environmental justice. For 3 to 4 years, myself and my good friend and colleague from Virginia, Representative McEachin, have been working with frontline and environmental justice communities and organizations across this country to craft a piece of legislation that'll codify the protections, the rights that environmental justice and frontline communities have with regard to decisions that are being made that affect their lives in a very direct way. We don't have to debate study upon study upon study where the burden and the brunt of pollution, climate change, permitted emissions, where they hit the hardest. They hit the hardest in communities of color, poor communities, and indigenous communities across this country. That's the pattern. It's irrefutable, it's empirical, and it's fact. The legislation, the Environmental Justice for All Act, begins to address that disparity and that discriminatory act that has been going on for decades upon decades since the industrialization of our country. Two things are critical to this. Three things, actually. That this piece of work is not Representative McEachin and my work. It is the work of community. It is the work of the communities most affected by these polluting industries, those frontline communities, those justice communities that have raised the issue time and time again to us that they are being asked to carry the burden for the rest of communities in this country. And a burden that is placed on them by the permitting, by local, state, and federal agencies across this country and the governments that see these communities as powerless, that see these communities as marginalized, and therefore that's where these industries go. And the consequences are documented as to the public health of all these communities across the country. Now, our bill deals with that reality by incorporating cumulative effect. It's not just one polluting industry. It's the cumulative effect of those industries and those extractions and the effect that they have on a community. The negative effect, the public health effect. The other issue is redress. We amend the Civil Rights Act to include environmental justice as an issue that can be brought to federal court under the Civil Rights Act when there is an act of discrimination and deliberate actions that hurt a community in a disproportionate way, particularly if that community is of color. So that's the bill in a nutshell. To trying to codify equity into the discussion of environmental burden. And the same holds true for climate. And the same holds true for decisions this government, if any government makes, that affects the lives of people. They should be involved, they need to be involved, and they should be empowered to protect themselves. This is what the bill does. Environmental Justice for All Act. And we are going to continue. We've been to New York. We're going to go to Detroit, New Orleans, and into the Southwest, and in Los Angeles, and on Indian Country, and go to tribal areas across this country to bring the bill, to get support, to mark it up in the committee, and to send it to the floor of the House of Representatives. That's the urgency for me, and it's the urgency for the communities that we have been working with for close to 4 years. Environmental Justice for All Act, it's past due. It's about time to create some balance and to give every American and every resident of this country the same rights to protect themselves and to fight for their communities and keep them from being the dumping ground for the worst kinds of pollution that we have in this country. Thank you very much for the invitation, and I hope the conference is a good one.
So we thank Congressman Grijalva for his words today. And the next we're going to be hearing from a very special guest who does not need any introduction, but I'll give it anyway. He's Dr. Bullard. He is a distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy. He's also the director of the Bullard Center for Environmental and Climate Justice at Texas Southern University. He also co-chairs the National Black Environmental Justice Network, and he actually spoke at SEJ's first conference in Boulder, Colorado in 1991 on what may have been the first ever panel on environmental racism. Since then, some things have changed. Unfortunately, others have not. In this past 30 years, we got the father of environmental justice here to give us some history and context and bring us right into Houston today, where the issues are front and center like perhaps nowhere else. Please help me welcome Dr. Robert Bullard.
Good evening. I am a sociologist. I'm an environmental sociologist. But I tell people I do not do dead white man sociology. I do what's scientifically called kick-ass sociology. Welcome to Houston. What you see up on the screen is a prop. It's one slide. I'm not going to give my usual 30, 40, 50-minute slideshow. But I graduated from Iowa State University in 1976, long before a lot of you were born. My wife and I moved to Houston in that same year, and 3 years out of graduate school, I came home one day and from Texas Southern University in the Department of Sociology, where I had taught a class in methodology. And so I came home one day, my wife said, Bob, I've just sued the state of Texas. And she graduated from Drake Law School. I met her in Iowa, yeah, from Alabama. She's from Michigan, and we meet in Iowa. But we moved to Houston, and she said, I just sued the state of Texas. I said, you did what? I said, for what? She said, because the Texas Department of Health has a permit in front of it that would, if granted, would permit this landfill, I'm sorry, sanitary landfill, and we know there's nothing sanitary about a landfill, to be located in this predominantly black middle-class suburban neighborhood in northeast Houston. When I say predominantly black, that's like me saying my family is predominantly black. But this is Northwood Manor in northeast Houston, a suburb. And she said, I just filed in federal court, temporary restraining order. And I need somebody to assist in to do a study, because I have to go into court in 10 days. I need somebody to put on a map where all the landfills, garbage dumps, waste facilities in Houston on a map and tell who lives near and around. And I said, baby, you technically sued my employer. Now, 3 years, it takes 5 years to get tenure. So I didn't have tenure. My wife is suing my employer. She just went into court. She needs a study done. I said, you need a sociologist. She said, that's what you are, right? Now, that's a true story. That's how I got drafted. I got drafted in 1976. I also got drafted in 1968. Two times. By the Army. When I reported, I got drafted by the Marine Corps, because nobody was joining the Marine Corps and volunteering in 1968 in December. For you, all you folks who got gray hair, you know what that means. Marines were getting killed right and left in Vietnam. So the way I got selected, the way I got drafted by the Marine Corps was all volunteer. Hoorah. Nobody stepped up. And so this racist drill instructor, sergeant, said, nobody's stepping up, so eeny, meeny, miny, mo, every mo is going to Marine Corps. Now, if you don't know that racist little jingle, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, catch your N-word by the toe. If you hollers, let him go, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. I was the mo in the Marine Corps. So I got drafted then, and I got drafted by my wife. So I said, you need a sociologist. She said, what you are? I said, do you know how much work that is? Now, this was long before there was no Google, iPad, iPhone, GIS. There was none of that. I had 10 students in my research methods class, and I told my students at Texas Southern University, students, we have a research project. And when a professor tells a student, I had 10 of them at TSU, this was not a predominantly black class. This is all black. All 10 students were black. I told my students we have a research project that we have to go out and develop a methodology, a design, to find out where all the garbage dumps are, incinerators, waste facilities, solid waste sites in Houston. And I said, I'm going to design this study, and we're gonna do the study. And I designed the research protocol. This is 1976. And in Houston, there was Key Map Company. And we used base maps, old base map of Houston. And we had a poster board. You know how your kids do the science poster board thing? You know, we glued the poster board, the map on the poster board. We had magic markers. Yellow, less than 10%. Orange, 10 to 24.9% minority. Green was 25 to 49. Red was 50% more. So that was the color code. Those were the magic marker pens, magic marker colors, and we had map pens. We went to the library, old archival records, City of Houston, State of Texas reports, to pull together. This is now it's called mixed methods. Huh? That's what it's called now. But then it was like, damn, we need to figure out how to do this. Mixed methods. And I pulled together the master lists, and then I would give the key map crisscross. Houston is like, Houston like 600 square miles. And these things were all over the map. And so I give the students, you know, a list. They'd go out and try to verify, triangulate what's on the list, the map, and what they call windshield survey, eyeball it. Now, this is what I'm talking about now. And mixed methods. And when verification, ethnographic, this is anthropologists do. I'm a sociologist, but anthropologist. Ethnographic, meaning if you go out there and look on this, on your chart and your map and the streets, and there's nothing there, then the neighbor that's next door, you do your ethnographic, which is nothing more than knock on the door and ask the people, how long have you lived here? Do you know what was on that lot? Do you know what's in that area? Do you know what that bump over there is, that bump? I tell my students, Houston is flat. As a matter of fact, it's only like 54 feet above sea level. I tell my students, anytime you see a mountain in Houston, be suspicious. Huh? Do you know what I'm talking about? This is not L.A. When I left Houston, we went to L.A. We got nice mountains. But no mountains in Houston. I wrote an article in Sight magazine, which is a Rice design. It's called The Mountains of Houston. long story short, I'm going to speed it up. But I got to tell the Houston story because that's where it all started. Before there was a movement, before there was even concept of environmental justice, my wife developed the legal theory on environmental justice using civil rights law. Bean versus Southwestern Waste Management Corporation was the first lawsuit challenging environmental racism using civil rights law. And so when my students, we go out, they find the landfill, mark it up, we come back, verify, put a pin in the map, and it just so happened that when we color-coded the map with all the census tracts, and again, census tracts then were not in any database. There were maps, fold-out maps, where you had to actually piece the maps together to come up with the actual maps in a map book like this thick. This is ancient. Some of the research we had to do is go to the library to verify what was written up on these so-called landfills because they weren't there. We call that artifacts. And the way we did the research is to go to the library that had old card catalogs and newspapers were on microfiche. I'm talking ancient now. Research like with a hammer and a chisel on microfiche. If you don't know what microfiche is, you go to the library. They're in little boxes, film in little boxes. You put them on crank them on a little machine, and then you turn it like that. And then the newspaper will come up on the screen, and we found a lot of old sites. fast forward to the results. That's all preliminary. What we found with the crude methodology was that five out of five of the city-owned landfills were in predominantly black neighborhoods. 6 out of 8 of the city-owned incinerators were in predominantly black neighborhoods, and 3 out of 4 of the privately owned landfills were in predominantly black neighborhoods. From the 1930s up until 1978, 82% of all the garbage, solid waste disposed of, dumped in Houston, was dumped in black neighborhoods, even though blacks made up only 25% of the population. I have traveled all across this country, been to every state. I have never seen black communities getting 82% of the good stuff, and what's left, that 18%, is for the white folks. I've never seen that. But in this case, 82%. This was not a poverty pocket. This was not a ghetto. This was a black middle-class suburban neighborhoods of homeowners. 85% of the residents owned their homes. There was nothing out in Northwood Manor in 1978 except trees, houses, and black people. And in Houston, where there's no zoning, it was ruled. And it was thought to be compatible in terms of garbage being compatible with garbage. That's what it was saying, by saying this is okay. We went in federal court. First, it was in the only black female district judge in the South. And when it was, and she kept it in court for like from 79 to 85. Went to court in 85. It was transferred out of Judge Gabrielle McDonald's court into Judge Singleton's court. That judge must have been 150 years old. He was calling us Negras. I ain't lying. If you don't know what Negra is, like a fancy way of saying the N-word. He was calling the residents in the community, the plaintiffs. And when I laid out the pins, where the pins were in the red. 82% of all the pins were in the red. And I was talking about this black neighborhood, and he was, oh, I know where that Negra neighborhood is. So this is the time. The case was brought ahead of its time. We lost that case in federal court, but it gave birth to a new methodology, a new design, a new frame, legal framework, and a new research area that was birthed out of that particular case. This is 1979. Four years before, there was an environmental justice movement that was born in Warren County, North Carolina. Again, over a waste dumping and environmental racism. I wrote that case up in 1983. It got published in Sociological Inquiry, and I wrote it up in Invisible Houston. What you see on the screen are some of the books that I've written. Let me pull out my cheat sheet, because titles: Invisible Houston, Dumping in Dixie. Dumping in Dixie is a story in and of itself. When I finished Invisible Houston, because I looked at racism, how it not only impacted environmental protection and environmental quality, I looked at systemic racism. The title of the book is Invisible Houston. The subtitle, Invisible Houston. Boom and bust. Something like that. The fact is that no matter whether the town was booming or whether it was bust, black people basically were staying pretty much the same during the cycles of oil, et cetera, because we were not fully integrated into the black experience in boom and bust. And after I wrote that, I said, I want to expand my Houston study to the South. And so I expanded it to look at what was going on in Dallas, all the lead smelters, the Houston study, what was going on in Louisiana Cancer Alley, what was going on in the largest hazardous waste facility in the country was located in the Alabama Black Belt in Sumter County, which is 75% black, and then in Mel, Alabama, that was 95% black. And then I went all the way to West Virginia. And a lot of folks said, well, there's black people in West Virginia? Yeah. They left in 1865 and went with freedom when West Virginia broke away from Virginia and said, well, we're going to be free. We don't want to be a slave state. There were black folks that went with West Virginia. And they settled in this little area in the Kanawha River Valley. Anybody West Virginian? You know what I'm talking about. That's where they settled. And West Virginia needed a place to put his Jim Crow school. And they put it right in that black community, and they created the West Virginia Colored Institute. So Institute West Virginia was a place that housed Union Carbide chemical plant, the place in the country that manufactured methyl isocyanate, yeah. Anyway, that the same chemical that killed all those people in Bhopal, the only place they manufactured that was in Institute. So the idea was, I wanted to see, is that same pattern that we found in Houston with black communities getting dumped on? I finished the manuscript in 1989. I couldn't get a publisher for a whole year. And I got nasty notes back from publishers saying, the environment is neutral. Everybody's treated the same. Why are you saying there's racism in the environment? America is segregated, and so is pollution. That was my response in 1989 to publishers. And I got rejection. I still got a lot of them rejection letters. But that didn't stop me. And finally, I ended up getting a press that publishes a lot of environmental books in Boulder, Colorado. Any Boulder? Any Colorado? Well, I don't know. It's something about Boulder. If you've ever been to Boulder, mountain high air, bean sprouts, tofu, marijuana. They decided to publish my book. They published the book. They made it a... It's only 160 pages. They made it a textbook. I was mad as hell. I said, damn, who can afford a $25 book? Students. They made it a textbook, and it got adopted, and it got where? But anyway, the idea was, let me back up. With the Houston case, we took the data that I just talked to you to environmental groups, white environmental groups, and they said to me, oh, I showed them the data, said, oh, isn't that where this landfill is supposed to be? Now this is 1979, only 9 years after the first Earth Day. I took the same information to the oldest civil rights organization. I won't call any names, but we know the initials. And they say, well, we don't do housing. We just do housing. We don't do environment. And so we got no traction from either one. It took us almost 20 years for the environmental civil rights to converge. It's called the environmental justice movement. Let me just wind down. Each one of those books, whether you talk about confronting environmental racism, unequal protection, I got my Sierra Club book. Sierra Club was founded in 1892. I challenged Sierra Club to do a real book, not just a coffee table book. And they said, what do you mean? I challenged him. He said, what do you mean? We do great books. I said, do a book about justice, about environmental racism. And they said, oh, no, you're right. We never done it. And I said, Michael Fisher said, you got one? I set him up. I said, yeah. I said, here's the outline. Here's the outline. He said, oh, this looks good. 15 chapters. How much have you done? I said, I got it boxed up. 1992, Unequal Protection, Environmental Justice, and Communities of Color. It took 100 years. 1992. A little slow. But now, and that Unequal Protection book was such a good sell for Sierra Club. Sierra Club members buy Sierra Club books. We don't know why. They said, Dr. Bullock, can you do another one? I did The Quest for Environmental Justice, Human Rights and the Politics of Pollution, 2005. I hear you. My time is up. Shut up. So my point I was making is that each one of those books, Sprawl City, that's about planning in Atlanta, or lack thereof, and the environmental impacts of planning. Just Transportation, 1997, 2004, Highway Robbery, Transportation Racism, New Routes to Equity. That's what we see right now in Houston's Fifth Ward and Independence Heights, highway robbery, stealing black wealth in housing, equity, businesses, et cetera. And Hurricane Katrina, book, Race, Place, and Environmental Justice after Hurricane Katrina. And the last book that I wrote is called The Wrong Complexion for Protection, How the Government Responds to Disaster Endangers African-American Community. The way that the government has responded to disasters in many African-American communities of color, actually, the response oftentimes is more disastrous than the original disaster, because monies for recovery generally don't flow to need. It's money following money, money following whites, and money following money, money following power, money following whites. And there's excellent studies by professors at Rice University and University of Pitt showing how perverse that whole formula is, and that affluent white communities generally end up better off after these huge disasters by $126,000. After these $10 billion severe weather events, end up $126,000 better off in terms of wealth. Whereas communities of color end up about $29,000 worse off. That's the wrong complexion for our protection, and that's the wealth theft that we're talking about that we're trying to resolve with Justice 40 plan and the equity analysis for infrastructure, that $1.2 billion, trillion, I'm sorry, with a T, infrastructure. Because infrastructure historically has divided communities. Roads, who gets on the other side of the levee, the money is over there, paved. Not, see, I grew up in Alabama. No paved streets, no street lights, no water system, but we pay taxes. We just didn't get any money from it. We're trying to correct that. And the way we correct the injustice is to acknowledge, own up to it, and design policies that go to the heart of it. Poverty is not a proxy for racism. Black middle class, the neighborhood that was the subject of the lawsuit was not a poverty pocket. It was not a disadvantaged community. These are black middle class folks who worked two jobs, paid their house note, and voted and did everything right, but yet and still they still got dumped on. We say no to that in 1970. We said no to that in 1979. We say no to that 42 years later, fighting the same battle. And when we were there, we could not get many journalists to tell the real story. Things have changed. 1979, environmental justice was a footnote. Today, it's a headline. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bullard, for that enlightening presentation. We are so lucky to have you here. Dr. Bullard will be back with us Friday morning at our opening plenary session, so you know you don't want to miss that. The next portion of the evening is going to go a little bit differently. We're going to watch a short documentary by John Fiege titled Shoulders Deep about the long-lasting impact that Harvey had on one family and their resilience in the aftermath.
Oh my God, y'all. I remember me looking outside the window in the living room. And I remember seeing the water there, and my older one said, "And I don't be loud, don't cry, don't worry, because Kimmy is in the room sleeping, and I don't want you to wake her up." And so, like, during all that time, I was trying to be all strong and stuff like that and not cry, because I didn't want to scare my little sister or anything like that. The fact that a boat was floating in the middle of the street scared the heck out of me. I didn't realize, well, of course I realized how deep the water was because it was up to my shoulders, but I realized the change that was going to happen after the fact. The houses in our neighborhood were all flooded. It was about 2 feet of water into our home. We lost the walls, we lost the floor, the counters, the furniture. A lot of things we had to replace after that.
We had to move out of the house because it was not fit for us to live in. So we stayed at the hotel, myself, LaWanna, which is my sister, and Cammie, and Anaya lived with her godmother and Tanisha because her daughter and I went to school together. And we stayed separated for 6 months, Anaya, myself, and my sister and Cammie were all, and I was in one place and we were in a hotel. So that was 6 months before we could actually move back in after the house was reconstructed. when I got over there, and he was like, you needed to talk to me. You came downstairs like you normally did. You stood in front of me, and you just broke down crying, and you said, Mama, this is so hard. And I started asking, I was wrong. You crying, I'm crying. And I felt so helpless. That was hard. Mm-hmm. It was very, very hard. I felt like I was abandoning you. You know, it's like you're abandoning your child. Even though you know that you're doing what only you can do. Mm-hmm. You know, there was nothing else I could do.
Facts. Shut in, pinned down, cut off, confined. Compressed along the edges, boxed myself within the lines. Harvey dripping off my fingertips, smelled the bayou in my hair. The stench of pain stuck on my clothes, questioning God, do you even care? Anxious, sitting legs crossed as the walls decrease in longitude. At this latitude, really, I think I've lost each inch of gratitude. Facts. Water flooding through my soul, wrapping its waves around memories of the bedroom I slept in, the smell of home I've now forgotten for 6 months straight. Death breathing through my every move for each day, 6 months straight. Ordered footsteps, designation, molding the shape of my space. Harvey took my space. Harvey took my bed away. Harvey had me at a lady's crying every single day. Path corrupted mass destruction, but I carved my own way, and my power only grows, although Harvey never gave mine back to me. And that's facts, y'all. Period.
Harvey is rooted in me. I feel like it's important to portray the entire story of not only me, but my support system. Not only my pain, but the pain that the people around me have experienced. Yes. The environment, my city, my neighborhood, my school, my friends, and my family. That's the most important to me. Through some way, through dance and art, poetry, film, I really want the audience, friends, family, everyone besides me to physically, mentally, and spiritually feel everything that was taken away from me, but how things shifted in a positive way for me to gain everything that I've gained since then.
we thank Anaya Wingate, who also fortunately couldn't be here, and John, who is currently working on the post-production of a feature documentary related to this short called Racing Anaya. And now, if you bear with us, we have besides Dr. Buller, the best part of the program, we're joined by three amazing youth leaders of this community. We have Marco Garcia, who's an undergraduate student at the University of Houston. He's majoring in philosophy and minoring in energy and sustainability. He has worked with a number of environmental groups, including Air Alliance Houston, the Environmental Defense Fund, and the Sunrise Movement. We have Bianca de la Cruz and Bianca Ramirez, which both are student interns with TEJAS, a local environmental justice advocacy organization, and green ambassadors at FIRR High School. Something very special about FIRR High School is the first environmental justice school in the country, and they focus on green initiatives like tree planting, but also encourages students to engage with environmental issues. So please help me welcome our three guests. So we just saw this very moving video about Harvey. I don't know if you, and we can start with Marco, I don't know if you remember Harvey in particular, or is there any other man-made or natural disaster that particularly sticks with you?
So I've lived in Houston my whole life, so I sort of vividly remember evacuating for past hurricanes, I think Hurricane Harvey was, like for many people, was sort of like an awakening moment, like even more so than prior hurricanes. I think I went through, if you were in Houston at all, I think we all sort of had a similar experience in the buildup to it. So like, you know, gathering food and like trying to ration food for like a week. For me specifically, the first semester for college was delayed because it happened, and it actually happened during my birthday, just kind of interesting. I sort of went through that similar experience, but I was fortunate enough that compared to others, like the damage for myself wasn't as nearly as bad as some others, even like professors of mine who whenever I went to college were dealing with like having to have relocated and things like that. But that's sort of my experience. It was just I think I was surrounded by water like most other people, but thankfully it wasn't as terrible as a lot of other, I also had like friends and people I worked with and peers and things like that, and people like that who were affected like directly.
Bianca with a big B.
So my experience with Hurricane Harvey, I can't speak much of my experience with Hurricane Harvey, but I can speak about two different sides of the economic spectrum whenever it comes to natural disasters and people of different economic stances. My parents are divorced, so I live in two different households every other weekend. During Harvey, I was with my mother. We lived in the Sheldon-Wallaceville area, so we weren't heavily impacted by Harvey. Thankfully, we didn't lose power. We were worried about food resources, though, since we are a big family. My mother and her three daughters, so there was four of us in the house. Thankfully, we ended up getting through Harvey fine. We didn't lose power. The house didn't flood. I did have family who were affected by Harvey. My tia at the time was pregnant, and she had Braxton Hicks at the time. So she had thought that she had gone into labor. So that was my experience with Harvey. But my experience during the winter storm was something completely different. My father, he lives on Mercury by FIRR High School, which is a school that I go to. We live in a very old house on Valencia Drive. During the winter storm, we had lost power. Our water got frozen. And so we had to like worry about like, oh, like the food in the fridge is gonna go bad. Like it's getting like really cold, so like where can we like find like shelter to like escape the cold? Especially since like I had like a really, well, I have a younger brother. Our pipes ended up busting, which whenever I talked about the winter storm with my mom's side, my stepdad was at the house at the time, and they were doing relatively fine. So the neighborhood was the Three Lakes, and everything was fine, the power was fine, but then you look at Songwood, people on Songwood forums were saying that many bad things were happening, like the water, the power, like their kids were like freezing. Thankfully, we were able to stay with my tía, but...
So you got to see the different impact on depending on where you live.
Yes.
And Bianca, any specific disaster that sticks with you that you've...
So my experience with Harvey, I did have to relocate because there was a point that we really did think we were going to get flooded. Mm-hmm. And our electricity did go out. And the house that we relocated to, there was actually other families that were there too. The nice couple that was there helping us, they also allowed different families. And so what my role was in that house was to take care of the little kids because, well, I was taking care of the little kids and, you know, keeping them calm, taking care of them. Their parents were going to their own houses. And, you know, elevating things, trying to save as much as they could. My neighbor actually did get pretty flooded. And I was taking care of her kids. And luckily, my house didn't get flooded. Not as badly as, like, you know, my neighbor. But that experience really did stuck with me because... most of my peers didn't quite understand my situation. Because, you know, they had, like, more resources. Mm-hmm. But either way, that actually happened for several different natural disasters, including the freeze. Except in the freeze, you know, everybody's electricity went out. For me, my electricity completely went out, and the water in our house was coming in and out periodically. But, you know, my family has experience in construction. So we did have a generator that we use in the night because that's when it got the coldest. And during those times, if our neighbors needed, like, their phone charge or something, we would take them, we would charge it for them, and then return it in the morning. Concerning other than that, we also gave advice to anybody we could. Either it was during phone calls or to our neighbors, we'll be like, hey, this is how you keep your water pipes from bursting. This is how you preserve water that you do have. This is how you keep your house warm. And it was also... By this time, obviously, I was in high school. The Harvey was when I was in middle school, which is, again, two different circumstances. And...
So it seems from what you're saying that youth in Houston grow up becoming experts in how to deal with natural disasters.
Either natural disasters or man-made disasters. Was it Harvey or one of the hurricanes that led you to become quite active on environmental issues? Because I know all of you, in different ways, are, you know, whether it's through your high school or through the Sunrise Movement, thinking about environmental issues and trying to do good in that respect. And so was it the hurricanes that caused you to sort of become more active on this front, or what led to the awareness and deciding to take action?
It was definitely a process.
Yeah.
And it was levels and levels of different things that kept either happening or people that aren't aware of.
Uh-huh.
And also things that I wasn't aware of until I became aware of them. Then I became very invested in the situation. But it was more than natural disasters. It was also environmental inequalities, specifically also with like race and then indigenous and people with low incomes and you know, situations like that. So that's what got me really invested and, you know, going forward.
Yeah. What about you, Bianca?
Well, I've always been invested in like the upkeep of our environment ever since I was little. There was like never a time where I was like a litter bug. I was always telling people, hey, you should like pick up your trash. And if, I remember spending my recess days picking up trash outside the playground and putting it into recycling and then trash. But I didn't really understand that that was like environmental justice at the time. Mm-hmm. But I would say that the time that the thing that really got me into environmental justice was the ITC fires. Because I remember talking to my mom. She's a pediatric nurse. Mm-hmm. During that time of the ITC fires, asthma cases in the pediatric ward were increasing, and it was mostly because of the chemicals that were being released during the ITC fires. And I remember telling my mom, like, but why do these kids have to like basically suffer through this? Because of someone else, like because the tanks that were holding the chemicals were old, like. Why is it that the upkeep wasn't looked towards, like, why was it not a big deal for that upkeep to be taken into consideration? So ever since then, I finally, like, got more into environmental justice. And then when I went to FIR, because the ITC fire was during my ninth grade year, which I was at a different school at the time. But once I transferred to FIR and I figured out about their FFA program and then I met Nayeli through Tejas, mm-hmm. I finally figured out more about the injustices of like lower income neighborhoods, and I remember wanting to stand up for that because it's something that I feel passionate about.
That's great. And what about you, Marco?
I've tried to answer this question like 1,000 times, like in my head. Like, yeah. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people here have like, you know, where did that come from? Like, where did I get that? Like, why did I become interested in environmental issues aside from the obvious fact that, you know, that it's for the common good, right? Like, it seems plain. But I think for me, it came sort of interestingly, and I think maybe this is true for some people. Like, so a few years back, I actually went, I fully went plant-based and I went vegan, and I'm still vegan today. And a big part of that was doing research, and I was fresh out of high school, so I wanted to be healthy, and I wanted to be, you know, all of these, like, very young-minded things, I think. But as you study veganism, as anyone who knows who studied veganism, you run into a lot of environmental issues that are not just, that don't just pertain to food issues. And so I think in that way I sort of discovered, like, environmental issues in general. But I think the point at which it became, like, a political issue for me and that I wanted to, like, not just, you know, change my own consumerist behavior, was the rise of Donald Trump. And so the election of 2016 for me, it was like a pivotal moment. And I've talked to a lot of friends too who are like activists too, and this seems to be like a key point as well. So I think for me, when it became like a sort of a political issue, environmentalism, when I wanted to, you know, fight for certain issues, it was during the 2016 election campaign. That's when I started like I joined the Bernie Sanders campaign, and then afterwards, when Donald Trump won, I felt that like I didn't want to focus as much on like federal, like level actions, and I said, you know, like what can I do in my community? You know, mm-hmm. what can I do right now, right here? And so that led me to not only study sustainability issues at the university level, but also to, as you mentioned, right? Like I've been a part of a number of organizations which are like specifically local. So like Airlines Houston, like was my first like big jump into environmental like activism, and that was like in 2017, which was interesting because that was the year that not only Donald Trump got elected, but Hurricane Harvey hit that summer, mm-hmm. and so it was. I feel like my political activism and the environmental activism sort of came about during that you know, that confluence of factors. But yeah, that's probably for me, yeah.
So we have people here from hopefully all across the country. They're going to be in Houston for the next few days. What would you like them to know about some of the communities they're going to be visiting around environmental issues, both the challenges and things that you're hopeful for? Maybe Bianca, you want to start us off?
First of all, you're definitely going to see inequality, like, obviously. And that's also like what we're here for. But particularly when you go to each region and when you get to see everything, you get to see a lot of differences, obviously. But you also see people that don't recognize it or that don't see it as often, because me coming from like, well, you know, immigrant household, people often think like, oh, be grateful, you're here, you already have a lot of privileges, which is true, but we can't deny that there are problems here. And also, gotta say it, recognize your privilege, because when you recognize your privilege, you get to see a little more of the disadvantages people that don't have your privilege get to like experience themselves. For example, let's say if you have a family background where, you know, most of your family went to college, you have experience with that, you know exactly the process, what you need to prepare for and when you need to prepare it for. Meanwhile, people like me who are first generation, we're going blindsided. We don't know anything about the college process. And when you get to see that, you can kind of see, oh, well, where would I have been if I didn't have that experience, or if my family didn't have that experience? Which is also why I'm so grateful that for high school is partnered with Tejas, because it gives you a voice. It gives you opportunity to speak out about this and, you know, have people and bring awareness to it. And let's see.
Great, thank you,
Bianca. What would you like them to know?
Well, one of the things that, like, so I think it's by the Baytown area. There's this strip. I call it Factory City. There are many factories just side by side by side. And one common factor that you'll see in all these factories is that most of them are rusted. They're very, very old. The upkeep in the factories is neglected, and it's probably because the owners of these factories want to save a pretty penny. I would look for, I would also look for like the neighborhoods that you're in. You should know the ethnicities that live in those neighborhoods. Because if you check, they are a minority ethnicity. They are black and brown. They are of like black and brown people, and they are low income. And that's one thing that should be talked about. The fact that these factories are in lower income neighborhoods, and it's mostly because they can't speak up because they don't have the resource or the money to. And most of the families from these neighborhoods are Spanish-speaking. And whenever these factories do hold, like Valero in the Magnolia area, whenever they do hold, their conferences are never translated into Spanish, which is the second language in Texas, especially Houston, where many immigrant families live. I would look for, that's what I would look for.
Thank you.
Yes.
and Marco.
I think for me, if I were to go out there and be on tour with these things, I would ask, and you probably already figured this out as journalists, but don't just take things at face value. I mean, a lot of these things are going to seem wrong at face value, but I think the important thing for me, it's been, and living in the city, because it's so easy to become desensitized to like everything here in the city. I mean, it's a monster of a city. And you don't really understand that until you actually like travel around the city and you get to know like different areas, and it's like completely different worlds, and yet it's all within this city. So going back to what question I think I would go into each of these things is, you know, like you know, ask yourselves, like, why is this thing here? Like, what is the history of this thing? Because I think only that's whenever you really get into the solutions part of what we should be doing. Because, you know, it's easy to see, like, a refinery next to this, you know, black and brown community, or majority, like, you know, like, if you go to, like, I think you're going to the Ship Channel, and if you go south of the Ship Channel, you'll see, like, churches, neighborhood parks, neighborhoods, libraries. I mean, all of this stuff is easy to you know, just to be, you know, shocked by, but I think it's asking yourself, like, okay, like, what is the history of this place, and, like, why did this happen, or why is this a thing, you know, like, and so I think that's an important question, I think, just to keep in mind throughout all of these things is, like, is that history question, you know, and who were the people who are responsible for this, what companies are responsible for this, what, yeah, just the origins and, like, sort of that genealogical, like, thinking, I think is important.
Well, thank you all for being here. We're so happy that you were able to join us on a school night. Thank you, Marco, Bianca, all of you for being here and, you know, sharing your experiences both during Harvey, during the man-made disasters that you've been through. We're running a little short on time, so we have so many more questions planned for you, but unfortunately we're going to have to cut this short. So thank you so much for being here, and a big round of applause for Marco, Bianca, and Bianca. Thank you, guys. Some final housekeeping notes that I will now go over. If you haven't already, don't forget to sign up for the Friday Beat Dinners or join the SEJ Open Screen and share your videos, photos, and visuals with your peers, or start your own Beat Dinner in the Community tab on the Whova app. On Saturday morning, sign up for Speed Mentoring or join the fund for the Environmental Journalism Information Session to learn how you can get a grant of up to $5,000 to cover U.S. public lands. And also be sure to sign up for the many mini tours that we have planned for Saturday afternoon. And you can go hiking, biking, kayaking, or even pontooning. You may even get a chance to see prairie chickens on the lek. So sign up sheets are at the SEJ information desk. And there may still be some tickets available for the Saturday night dinner party at Rice. So please inquire at the registration desk. There is one more note about tour number one. If you are on tour one to go fishing and you want to fish, you need to buy a license. So, we will reimburse you. Please check your emails for details. It should be all laid out in your email. So please don't miss that email. Really important note if you want to fish. But then coming up first, bright and early tomorrow, some of these tours are super early in the morning, are the famous SEJ all-day tours. So please make sure to be at your bus well before your departure time. Please check your departure time. Plan to be there at least 10 minutes ahead of time. The departure times are actually when the bus will leave. So if you're not actually there, you will be left behind. So please do check on that. And for those of you who don't want to wake up at 6 a.m., we do have another option for you. The Highways Tour, led by Amal Ahmed and Megan Kimball, has a leisurely start time of 10 a.m. So there are still seats available on the bus, so please do sign up if you're looking for a tour for tomorrow. And for those of you who are going on tours tomorrow, please carry a bottle of water with you. We don't want you to get dehydrated out there. I think SEJ is organizing some drinks and things like that, but please carry your own bottled water. And yeah, thank you again for joining us this evening. We're so grateful to have you all here and to be in person at the conference. So thank you for being here and have a great rest of your evening. Thank you.